Trump has said repeatedly that he could have gotten the hostages out without giving anything in exchange. What do you say to that? What do you say to President Trump now, former president?
Why didn't he do it when he's president?
Sir, what objection?
Excellent answer, Mr. President. Smartly done.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's one reason.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast. That's heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. Also in California in Red Bluff and Redding in on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, and Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet to the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Desi Doyen, when I was running through those affiliates there, I noticed a couple of them jumped out at me. Our affiliate up in Redding, KFOI, which is not far from, I believe, where they are battling what is now the largest wildfire in the nation.
Yes.
The Park Fire up there. And I heard from one of our listeners up in Eugene, Oregon, listening via KEPW, that they are getting the effects of the wildfire smoke up there.
I am sorry to hear that.
As am I, which raises, well, we got a Green News report a little bit later that I don't want to tell anybody about because they may stick around to listen to it and they'll...
You'll definitely want to listen to this one. It has some excellent health information for you.
Oh, it's grim. It's grim. You don't want to hear it. But before we get there...
But there is good news at the end.
We'll see. Welcome to the Bradcast. We've got both good and bad news for you today, though whether it's good news or bad, that may be in the eye of the beholder, I think, for several of the stories we're covering today. Let's begin here. 2 months after his felony convictions, Donald Trump still is not allowed to say everything that he would like to about his historic hush money criminal case, in which, as you may recall, he was found guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide his sexual tryst with a porn star in a scheme that was meant to help him cheat to win the 2016 election, because that's how he rolls. Well, after a New York appeals court upheld that gag order in that case, on Thursday, he will still not be able to attack some of the people tied to the case or their family members, at least for a few more weeks. The state's mid-level appellate court denied the Republican former president and current nominee's latest bid to lift those restrictions, swatting away a last-minute argument that he's being unfairly muzzled. While Vice President Kamala Harris is likely a Democratic opponent, pits herself as an ex-prosecutor taking on a convicted felon. By the way, there's nothing in that gag order that prevents Donald Trump from defending himself if he would like to regarding the case. It just prevents him from, you know, attacking the family members of the judge and the prosecutors and so forth. A five-judge panel ruled that the trial judge, Juan Merchan, was correct in keeping parts of the gag order in place until Trump is sentenced, because the case is still pending and his conviction does not constitute a change in circumstances that would warrant lifting the gag order. It bars Trump from speaking about members of the prosecution team, court staffers, or their families, including Mershon's daughter, Judge Mershon's daughter, who's been the target of Trump's wrath in the past. In June, Judge Mershon lifted a ban on Trump publicly commenting about witnesses and jurors in the case after the trial itself was over. And he has always been free to speak directly about the judge himself or about Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, the Democratic district attorney whose office prosecuted the case. I will note a bit of irony here that Trump would have already been sentenced and likely had his gag order lifted, but for his corrupted activist right-wing Supreme Court majority, U.S. Supreme Court majority, which discovered a heretofore unnoticed presidential immunity clause hiding somewhere in our U.S. Constitution, and that has now resulted in the judge in this case in New York, Juan Mershon, delaying Trump's sentencing to consider Trump's motion that the entire case must be thrown out entirely due to that ridiculous and wildly corrupt Supreme Court ruling. To that end, we will be joined momentarily by attorney Jay Willis of the court reform website Balls and Strikes to discuss Joe Biden's recent call for, yes, Supreme Court reform, including a constitutional amendment to establish beyond a shadow of a doubt that no, presidents are not actually kings and they are not actually immune from criminal prosecution for crimes carried out while serving in office. For the moment, Trump is now scheduled to finally be sentenced for his 34 felony convictions in New York State on September 18. But the case and the gag order itself could be terminated entirely before that if Mershon grants a defense request to throw out the convictions in line of that Supreme Court presidential immunity ruling. The judge says he plans to rule on that on September 6. So mark your calendars. In other news, in what seems to me to be very good news today, and perhaps even a bit of recognition by Russian President Vladimir Putin that the odds of Donald Trump becoming president again may have plummeted in recent days. That's just my sort of own casual observation around this story, but the U.S. and Russia completed their biggest prisoner swap in post-Soviet history on Thursday, with Moscow finally releasing journalist, Wall Street Journal journalist Evan Gershkovich, fellow American and Marine vet Paul Whelan, who has been imprisoned in Russia for some 6 years now since going out there to attend a wedding. Also, dissidents, including Vladimir Kara-Murza, a Kremlin critic and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer who is serving 25 years on charges of treason, widely seen as politically motivated, as well as multiple associates of the late Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, in a multinational deal that set some two dozen people free. The trade unfolded despite relations between Washington and Moscow being at their lowest point since the Cold War after Putin's February 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Negotiators in back-channel talks at one point explored an exchange involving Navalny himself, but after his death in a Russian prison in February, well, they ultimately stitched together a 24-person deal that required significant concessions from European allies, including the release of a Russian assassin, while securing freedom for a cluster of journalists, suspected spies, political prisoners, and others. The deal, like similar ones before it, according to AP, reflected an innate imbalance. The U.S. and its allies gave up Russians charged or convicted of actual serious crimes in exchange for Russia releasing journalists and dissidents and others imprisoned by the country's highly politicized legal system. on charges seen by the West as trumped up. All told, six countries released at least one prisoner, and a seventh country, Turkey, participated by hosting the location for the swap in Ankara. President Joe Biden, on Thursday afternoon, trumpeted the unprecedented multinational exchange, by far the largest in a series of swaps with Russia, as a diplomatic feat, while welcoming families of the returning Americans to the White House.
Well, good afternoon. And this is a very good afternoon. A very good afternoon. Today, we're bringing home Paul, Evan, Alsu, Vladimir. Three American citizens and one American green card holder. All four have been imprisoned unjustly in Russia. Paul for nearly 6 years, Vladimir since 2022, Evan since March of 2023, and Alsu since October of 2023. Russian authorities arrested them, convicted them in show trials, and sentenced them to long prison terms with absolutely no legitimate reason whatsoever, none. Paul, a former Marine, was in Russia for a wedding. Evan, a journalist with a Russian in Russia, was in Russia, assigned by the Wall Street Journal. Alsu, also a journalist, was in Russia to see family. All three falsely accused of being spies. And Vladimir, who is a Russian citizen by birth and holds an American green card, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and was a pallbearer at my friend John McCain's funeral with me. He spoke out against Putin's regime. For that, he was convicted of treason. And now, their brutal ordeal is over, and they're free. Moments ago, the families and I were able to speak to them on the telephone from the Oval Office. They're out of Russia. Earlier today, they were flown to Turkey. And soon, they'll be wheels up on their way home to see their families. This is an incredible relief for all the family members gathered here. It's a relief to the friends and colleagues all across the country who've been praying for this day for a long time. The deal that made this possible was a feat of diplomacy and friendship. Friendship. Multiple countries helped get this done. They joined a difficult, complex negotiations at my request. And I personally thank them all again. And I've thanked them personally, and I'll thank them again. All told, Russia has released 16 prisoners. Eight Russians who are being held in the West will be sent home as well. These 16 prisoners from Russia that Russia has released include four Americans, five Germans, seven Russian citizens who are political prisoners in their own country. One of those Russians runs a human rights organization, Memorial, which won a Nobel Prize in 2022. Putin threw him in prison for voicing opposition to the war in Ukraine. Four others work with Alexei Navalny, political opposition leader who died in Russia prison this year. Now, they can live safely abroad and continue their work of advocating for democracy if they so choose. This deal would not have been made possible without our allies. Germany, Poland, Slovenia, Norway, and Turkey, they all stepped up and they stood with us. They stood with us. And they made bold and brave decisions. Release prisoners being held in their countries who are justifiably being held, and provide a logistical support to get the Americans home. So for anyone who questions whether allies matter, they do. They matter. And today is a powerful example of why it's vital to have friends in this world. Friends you can trust, work with, and depend upon, especially on matters of great consequence and sensitivity like this. Our alliances make our people safer. And we began to see that again today. Let me say this. It says a lot about the United States that we work relentlessly to free Americans who are unjustly held around the world. It also says a lot about us that this deal includes the release of Russian political prisoners. They stood up for democracy and human rights. Their own leaders threw them in prison. The United States helped secure their release as well. That's who we are in the United States. We stand for freedom, for liberty, for justice, not only for our own people, but for others as well. And that's why all Americans can take pride in what we've achieved today.
That was President Biden at the White House on Thursday. I should note he mentioned Alsu. That would be Alsu Kermisheva, a Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty journalist, a dual U.S.-Russian citizen convicted in July of spreading false information about the Russian military, an accusation that her family and employer have both rejected. The Biden administration has now brought home more than 70 Americans detained in other countries as part of deals that have required the U.S. to give up a broad array of convicted criminals, including for drug and weapon offenses. The swaps, though celebrated with great fanfare, have spurred criticism that they incentivize future hostage taking and give adversaries leverage over the U.S. And its allies. The U.S. government's top hostage negotiator, however, has sought to defend the deals against the criticism, saying that the number of wrongfully detained Americans has actually gone down even as these swaps have increased.
Hmm.
And you heard at the top of the show there, a journalist asked President Biden after a statement today about the criticism from some specifically from Donald Trump, who claims that, he'd have been able to get these people out without any sort of swap magically somehow. To which the president replied, well, why didn't he do it while he was president? All right, let's take a quick break here. We will, as noted, Green News Report will be coming up a bit later this hour.
Yes,
again, I'm loath to even mention it because it's a rather grim report today, even more so than usual.
But also followed by some good news.
Sort of. So, you know, forget we even talked about it. It'll just come when it comes. Anyway, quick break, and we'll come back with something almost certainly cheerier. The first real movements toward, yes, U.S. Supreme Court reform, or perhaps movement on the very long road towards U.S. Supreme Court reform, which President Biden has finally come out in specific support of, even as my guest is arguing, it's both long overdue and not nearly enough for real U.S. Supreme Court reform. And arguably, he suggests it comes far too late to see real change, at least under the current president. Jay Willis of Balls and Strikes, which is not a sports site, so don't worry. Jay Willis joins us next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
It's not too late to turn this ship around, to sail into the wind, my love, before we run aground. It's not too late.
Well, we'll see how late it is or isn't. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It might be too late for this administration in any event. On Thursday, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer led 34 of his Democratic Senate colleagues in introducing the No Kings Act, which would reaffirm that presidents and vice presidents do not have immunity for actions that violate federal criminal law, and they say would clarify that Congress, not the Supreme Court, determines whom federal criminal laws may be applied to. Quote, in a dangerous and devastating ruling, says Schumer in the Senate Democrat statement, the MAGA Supreme Court has once again subverted the will of the American people and the very idea of democracy itself. The founders, he continued, were explicit. No man in America shall be a king. Yet in their disastrous Trump v. U.S. decision, the Supreme Court threw out centuries of precedent and anointed Trump and subsequent presidents as kings above the law. Given the dangerous and consequential implications of the court's ruling, legislation would be the fastest and most efficient method to correcting the grave precedent the Trump ruling presented, says Schumer. The No Kings Act would, essentially do three things as they break it down. Reaffirm that presidents and vice presidents do not have immunity for actions that violate U.S. criminal law. Remove the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction for all actions challenging the constitutionality of this particular legislation, and would establish additional jurisdictional and procedural guardrails allowing the United States to bring criminal actions against a president or vice president in any applicable U.S. court. In addition to following on the corrupted, packed, extremist, activist Supreme Court majority's recent discovery from whole cloth of a heretofore unknown presidential immunity clause somehow hidden from view in the U.S. Constitution for some 250 years, the call by Chuck Schumer and his fellow Democrats for a new law to reestablish that presidents are not immune from criminal prosecution follows on President Biden's own recent call for reform at the high court. As first introduced on Monday in a Washington Post op-ed by the president, and then during his remarks at the LBJ Presidential Library in Austin, Texas, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, President Biden proposed three key reforms for the court: a constitutional amendment that he calls the No One Is Above the Law Amendment to similarly establish that presidents do not have immunity from criminal laws. He called for 18-year term limits for Supreme Court justices and for Congress to establish a binding and enforceable code of ethics for Supreme Court justices, barring them from accepting undisclosed gifts and sitting on cases in which they have clear conflicts of interest.
Today, I'm calling for three bold reforms to restore trust and accountability to the court and our democracy. I'm calling for a constitutional amendment called No One Is Above the Law Amendment. No immunity for crimes former president committed while in office. We're a nation of laws, not kings and dictators. And I believe we should have term limits for Supreme Court justices of the United States as well. I believe the best structure is the 18-year term limit. Reduce the chance that any single presidency imposes undue influence in generations to come. Third, I'm calling for a binding code of conduct for the Supreme Court. Supreme Court's current ethics code is weak and, even more frightening, voluntary. Justice would be required to disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, recuse themselves in cases in which they or their spouses have a financial or other conflict of interest. The court is not self-policing. The court is not dealing with the obvious conflicts of interest. We need a mandatory code of ethics for the Supreme Court, and we need it now.
President Biden speaking at the LBJ Presidential Library this week. Writing at the website Balls and Strikes, attorney Jay Willis notes that he generally supports the president's three major proposed reforms for the court, but argues that they are, quote, nowhere near sufficient. Until Democrats like Biden are willing to pair their support for term limits with adding justices to the court, the benefits of court reform will be limited to future generations. The hundreds of millions of people whose rights are on the chopping block every June will remain out of luck, writes Willis. He says that the only way to solve the problem of a court controlled by a conservative supermajority is to add justices to it. Backing term limits, Willis argues, without also backing court expansion is like explaining the concept of a life preserver to a person who is actively drowning. Joining us now is Jay Willis, editor-in-chief of Balls and Strikes, a website focused on the courts, named after now Chief Justice John Roberts' now almost laughable claim during his Senate confirmation hearings that the proper role of a judge is simply to, quote, call balls and strikes, not to pitch or bat. As I say, after some 20 years as chief of this radical activist and frankly not actually conservative in the least Supreme Court, Roberts' claim is simply laughable, but it does make for a great name for a website. about the courts. Ballsandstrikes.org is a project sponsored by DemandJustice.org, a nonprofit organization focused on court reform, judicial nominations, and related matters. O.J. Willis, thank you, sir, for joining us today on the broadcast.
Thank you for having me. Glad to discuss our country's 9 most famous, fanciest umpires with you.
There you go. But before we get to what you see as missing from Biden's long overdue court reform proposal, let me quickly talk about what the president is proposing. On their own merits, are these ideas for the court good ones as you see them?
Term limits and a code of ethics, you mean?
Yeah.
And the amendment that you've talked about.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. My attitude towards court reform is basically there. It's almost difficult to go far enough to repair an institution this broken.
Mm.
I think term limits are a really interesting one because, first of all, there is broad bipartisan support for term limits.
Right.
About 3/4 of Americans, and again, that's bipartisan support, favor 18-year term limits. I think a slightly higher percentage favors justices being subject to a binding ethics code.
Mm-hmm.
So these are not particularly controversial policy ideas. The only reason they're, you know, considered sort of politically difficult is because of the long tradition in this country of treating judicial service during periods of, and I'm quoting from the Constitution here, good behavior,
mm-hmm.
Effectively means life tenure. And I think it's important to just take a step back and remember that life expectancy around the ratification of the Constitution was like 35, 36, late 30s.
Really?
The founders just did not really contemplate that life tenure would amount to decades of service on the bench. To give you some perspective on this, Clarence Thomas has been on the Supreme Court right now for 32 years and counting. So you have this sort of weird anachronism where the framers were just thinking about what it meant, the tenure of a life completely differently than we do today.
Uh-huh.
I think if you were designing the Constitution from scratch, of course you would have term limits for justices, just like there are term limits for the other two branches of the federal government. Presidents can't serve more than 2 terms. Senators and members of Congress obviously aren't subject to term limits, but they are subject to retention elections every mm-hmm. 2 or 6 years.
Right.
No such mechanism exists for justices. Candidly, in my view, 18 years is like a pretty lengthy and generous term.
Yes.
If we were going to talk about limiting it.
Uh-huh. Well, on the idea, though, of these 18-year term limits, which I believe, you know, would allow for every sitting president, if I understand it, to sort of appoint a new justice to the court every 2 years, if you stick with the current number of 9. You note at Balls and Strikes that whether Congress can institute term limits by passing legislation is at best an open question in constitutional law. How so? I thought that Congress was allowed to, and in fact has, crafted the makeup of the court, how many justices it has, et cetera. Why would they not be able to determine term limits as well? Presuming they could get enough votes in both chambers of Congress to adopt such a law.
Well, like I say, it's sort of an open question, but I do think that that's an important thing to understand about term limits, which is, you know, unfortunately, maybe the most popular and common sense Supreme Court reform, term limits, is also the most legally fraught method of reforming the court, because the period of service for good behavior for federal judges and justices, that's in the Constitution. And that has always been sort of interpreted by courts to mean functionally life tenure. You get to serve on the court as long as you don't, you know, accept any bribes that are too big.
Uh-huh.
And even then, you know, maybe you get to stick around, depending on whether or not there's enough people to impeach you.
Right.
The size of the Supreme Court, by contrast, that is set by Congress. Congress has changed the size of the Supreme Court several times. Ooh, off the top of my head, I want to say it's been as low as 7
uh-huh.
and as high as 10 at one point.
Uh-huh.
It is sort of ping-ponged up and down, often depending on sort of political considerations. What the parties in control of the White House and the legislature wanted at that time. So There's no question that a simple act of Congress could add as many justices to the court as Congress feels like adding.
Uh-huh.
Now, there are arguments for how Congress could do the same with term limits, like at a very high level, sort of this idea that, you know, well, maybe if we impose term limits, we don't actually kick justices off the Supreme Court. Maybe they become, you know, senior judges. Maybe they rotate up and down from the Supreme Court to the federal appeals courts, such that, you know, they're not you're not depriving them of their judicial office.
Thus,
but it's
thus avoiding the constitutional language that they get to serve as long as they continue their good behavior.
That's exactly right. But of course, any legal challenges to that would go before what body? Federal judges, possibly, eventually, the Supreme Court, allowing the justices to rule on whether or not they can be stripped of their power. I usually don't like making predictions, but I do have a pretty good idea of how I think that one would go.
Yeah, no, obviously. I mean, if something like this would obviously go all the way to the Supreme Court, except couldn't an argument be made, Jay Willis, that, you know, Supreme Court justices must recuse themselves from this case since they have a very clear conflict of interest in deciding it?
I have not the foggiest idea what would happen if all nine justices were to recuse from a case. The good news, though, again, is that it's hard to get any one justice to recuse from anything in which they have a conflict of interest right now. So, again, without any binding ethics code that imposes any sort of recusal obligation, I think they're the ones who get to make their own decisions about their own job security.
Now, on this Biden's call for a no one is above the law amendment to the Constitution, it sounds very much like the No Kings Act law that was proposed to as opposed to a constitutional amendment that was proposed by Chuck Schumer and the Democrats on Thursday. Any idea why they are trying to do this as a law for the moment rather than as a constitutional amendment, given that it seems neither is going to be adopted anytime soon, given the almost certain opposition by congressional Republicans here?
Yeah, I mean, as difficult as it is to pass any sort of substantive legislation in this country, it is even more difficult to amend the Constitution. I want to say the last, like, real substantive constitutional amendment was lowering the voting age to 18, you know, almost five decades ago.
Yeah.
So that is a very tall order. Relatively speaking, passing legislation is much easier. And I understand why Democrats would push that as both a substantively good thing and also, at the very least, you know, messaging about the court and its role in democracy, doing politics, which is something, you know, Democrats occasionally forget how to do. The idea behind the Schumer approach is basically saying, look, every branch of government is obligated to interpret the Constitution. The judiciary does not have a monopoly on that power. And, you know, when there's a conflict between the way that different branches of government interpret the Constitution, maybe the tie should go to the people, you know, as expressed through members of Congress, rather than these nine unelected justices. So the idea would be that Congress would assert its own role in saying what the law is, interpreting the Constitution, deciding what it means. That is sort of the thrust of the Schumer approach, which is you can't, there's only so much you can do as long as the case is going before this Supreme Court. So why not figure out a way not to deal with them at all?
Well, that's what I was going to say. And I realize this is sort of a fraught question given this particular corrupted court, but presumably something like a law like this would also end up before the Supreme Court to determine its constitutionality. Is there any concerns about the constitutionality of what Schumer and the Democrats are putting together here?
I mean, something that the Supreme Court loves to quote is Marbury v. Madison, 1803 Supreme Court case that sort of created the concept of judicial review, of the court's ability to strike down legislation as unconstitutional. And in that decision, Chief Justice John Marshall famously said, it is emphatically the, oh God, I'm going real old English here, apologies, is the duty and province of the court to say what the law is.
Uh-huh.
It's the sort of really magisterial distillation of judicial power. Generally speaking, if you see it quoted in a Supreme Court opinion, it's because the justices are kind of trying to do some bullshit. they are sort of at the outer reaches of their power. But yeah, as long as John Roberts is in charge of this court, yeah, I would expect any challenge to a law like this, in an opinion that he or one of the Republican justices write, you're going to see a lot of that, you know, thanks for playing Congress. Thanks for your opinion on what the Constitution means. But this is really our job, not yours.
All right. So we will see on that. And of course, it'll be quite a while before that law that Schumer proposed this week actually makes any progress, if ever. But your central argument, Jay, it seems to be that while these proposed reforms are all well and good, they're long overdue, certainly, and seemingly most of them very popular with the American people. But all of this is ultimately pointless in one sense without the real reform of adding additional justices to expand the court, or, as I prefer to see it, unpacking the court. After Joe Biden, the institutionalist has finally come out for these long sought reforms, these other ones, and did so at the same time that he made it clear that these would be his last few months in public office. Why do you suppose he did not call for expanding the number of seats on the court on his way out the door?
Yeah, Joe Biden has consistently sort of resisted the idea of supporting court expansion. He did not support it as a candidate in 2020. As after he was elected president, his big sort of move on Supreme Court reform was convening a presidential commission on court reform, which obviously convening a presidential commission is the sort of thing you do when you want to appear to be doing something, but don't necessarily want anything to actually happen.
Right.
The writing was sort of on the wall for that commission when its membership, you know, of mostly law professors, judges, practitioners, its membership did not conclude any proponents of court expansion. It will probably shock you to learn that the book report that that commission produced did not recommend court expansion as one of its proposed interventions. So this just isn't something that, candidly, I don't know if Biden was ever going to do. And I think that's wrong as a matter of substance. I think it's a bad move politically. But also, as you say, like, he is now in his final few months of his presidency. I think that there is that a President Harris has the potential to be much stronger on Supreme Court reform than President Biden ever was. And so while I wish President Biden had done it sooner, I wish he had announced his support for more reform proposals, I'm at least glad that this is sort of like a mainstream issue in the Democratic Party now. As recently as I would say 5 or 6 years ago, you know, if you were talking about Supreme Court expansion, it was kind of like a fringe idea.
Right.
And now it is, you know, as a Democratic politician, you don't necessarily have to support it in order to win, but it'll probably help. And you're at least going to have to answer hard questions about it. And that, in my view, is an improvement over the old status quo.
Well, you you wrote a follow-up piece last week at Balls and Strikes headlined, "Where Does Kamala Harris Stand on Supreme Court Reform?" So I will bite. Since the now presumptive 2024 presidential nominee and former Senate Judiciary Committee member, she's been among the sharpest critics, really, of the right-wing court for some time, certainly following their overturning of 50 years of precedent to reverse abortion rights established by Roe v. Wade, but also during the confirmation hearings for Trump's three far-right justices, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett. So do you have any sense of where she stands on both the Supreme Court reform ideas that Joe Biden is putting forward and on, yes, the idea of expanding the court? Has she spoken to that either in recent years or during her previous presidential run back in 2019?
Yeah. So as a current presidential candidate, she has already sort of signed on to the reforms that President Biden is supporting. But as you sort of note, it goes even further. As a presidential candidate in 2019, Harris blamed Republicans for creating a, quote, crisis of confidence in the court. Mm-hmm. And as to the idea of adding justices, she said she was interested in and open to the idea. The full sentence quote is, "We have to take this challenge head on, and everything is on the table to do that." And to me, that's just sort of, I mean, there's two things that are encouraging about that. Number one, again, that like openness to Supreme Court expansion is, you know, leagues further than Joe Biden has ever done.
The Overton window has moved, it feels like, at least on that question.
That's exactly right. Just the mindset that she brings to this. Yeah. Everything is on the table to do that. Like, again, my position on Supreme Court reform is kind of like, yes, and I support as many different interventions as are necessary to fix this broken court. And I'm encouraged by the fact that, you know, the Democratic Party's nominee has a history of expressing sort of similar open-mindedness, curiosity, not feeling a loyalty to the status quo, but really thinking about using the power of the presidency and of the legislature to get done whatever needs to get done.
Mm-hmm. This may be, and last question here, last thought, and it may be more of a political one, I guess, than a legal or constitutional one, but she's run a fairly flawless campaign, at least in the, you know, the few days since Joe Biden dropped out and endorsed her at the top of the ticket. Would her coming out in favor right now of expanding the Supreme Court, would that offer up fuel to her, you know, Republican opponents that they have not been able to come up with so far? Or alternately, is, in fact, this the time to show leadership on something like this and to push public support in favor of such an idea? As you said, it's I think it's a popular idea, not as popular as the other reforms, but it's I think sort of 50-50 at this point as far as expansion goes. Is it a good idea politically to push it now or to bring it up later on down the road?
Yeah, so putting some numbers on this, Supreme Court expansion is does not enjoy the sort of sky-high, you know, approval ratings for ice cream and puppies that Supreme Court term limits and an ethics code have.
Mm-hmm.
But support for court expansion is higher than it's been in recent years. So, for example, in September 2023, 54% were in favor, you know, a slight majority.
Yeah.
If you go back to 2019, it was only 42%.
Uh-huh.
So I think the lesson I take from that is that Supreme Court expansion is not as popular yet, but also it's increasing. And also it notably spikes when the Supreme Court issues a decision that normal people do not like.
Uh-huh.
It spikes after Dobbs. You know, it spikes after the student loan invalidation, things like that.
Yeah.
And I think sort of the political lesson to take here is that voters understand the importance of control of the Supreme Court in a way that they haven't previously. And, you know, traditionally, mainstream Democratic politicians have shied away from taking on the court too much. You know, they've been very deferential to our tripartite system of government, separation of powers, and so on. And I think what Democrats are learning is that actually it's okay to run against a historically unpopular high court consisting of six Republicans. Mm. It's actually good politics to run against the court that is taking reproductive autonomy away from half the country, that is striking down student debt relief for the middle class, that is creating a right to carry a gun in public, and so on and so forth. Whether or not Harris, you know, endorses Supreme Court expansion as a presidential candidate to me is less important than the mindset that she brings to the idea of court reform, mm-hmm. and more importantly, the extent to which court reform is becoming a mainstream issue among Democratic candidates.
I think I got it. I think I understand that. And of course, she is absolutely running against this court, taking that extra step and specifically calling to expand the court. That may or may not be a bridge too far, or may or may not be a bridge that is necessary for her to cross in the next 3 months or so until Election Day. Will be a very interesting one to watch. And we will, of course, watch your coverage of this over at Balls and Strikes. Jay Willis is an attorney and editor-in-chief at ballsandstrikes.org. By the way, their tagline is, quote, deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition since 2021. A bit of pretty hilarious inside commentary for close Supreme Court watchers. Well done, Jay. You can also follow them on the Twitters at Ball Strikes. Jay Willis, really appreciate you joining us today. Hope to do it again soon.
Appreciate you. Thank you again for having me.
Thank you. So, you know, I think the important thing to keep in mind here is that So Joe Biden comes out with this, what, 3 months before the election day,
right,
obviously.
Right.
Nothing is going to happen in Congress in those 3 months. Nothing is likely to happen in Congress. But thereafter, particularly while the filibuster is still in place in the Senate and so forth. And it all depends on, you know, who wins the majority
exactly.
in November.
Yeah.
But the idea here is, you know, Republicans do this. They spend years and years on these topics. They spend years and years moving the Overton window to, you know, to the things they want to talk about, make sure that they become the part of our mainstream parlance.
Yeah.
And that seems to be what we're seeing the very first steps of here. And, you know, in the future, you'll be able to ask presidential candidates of Senate, House, you know, where you stand on these things. Until eventually you get to a consensus and you can get something done. That's how it's supposed to work.
Right. And
so,
I think
glad to see them jumping in and getting their ball rolling, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I think that it does do, I hope it does, a lot to change that conversation, especially among conservative Democrats who have blocked any kind of court reform in the U.S. Senate. But again, as
you're talking about Sinema and Manchin?
Yes.
They're gone anyway
exactly.
after this November. So
there
you go.
Now a pathway is opened, but only if the Democrats hold the U.S. Senate majority and also gain the House majority, but especially on the Senate majority.
And, by the way, hold the White House.
Well, just that too. Yes, of course. Of course, and they also have to get enough of a majority of senators who are willing to get rid of the filibuster. Now, I think part of Biden's strategy to not talk about court expansion, that's probably because he's an institutionalist, but I also wonder if perhaps it might be to not drop that little bomb in front of the Kamala Harris campaign at this particular moment when there's a lot.
Madam Vice President, do you support packing the court?
Exactly.
Because you know that's how the media describes it, packing the court.
Exactly. So keeping that from becoming a
and
major
it's
issue
unpacking
is
the
smart.
Court.
Exactly.
Let me be clear. It is unpacking the court. It's a corrupted court. It has been stolen. It has been packed
by Republicans.
This would be unpacking it if, in fact, they expanded it.
Exactly. So just giving that little bit of a breathing room there before the media descends upon, you know, these things that would cause problems potentially for the Harris campaign among independent voters. So.
Well, given the way the polls are moving right now in her direction, she certainly doesn't need to do it. So I guess an argument can be made. Let's talk about that later.
Right.
At least that part. Talk about these other wildly popular things, term limits and so forth.
That are also important.
That you can already talk about,
yep.
I guess. That's the thinking. Okay, quick break, and we're back with something right after this break that will be
the Green News Report.
Oh, there you go. I can hear everyone just walking away now. Anyway, no, it's a fine one. It's not scary at all. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Do not touch that dial. Hey, this is Brad. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only one that keeps us here. Thank you. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yes, melting for you. A lot of heat. A lot of heat around the country right now and still.
And around the world.
All summer long.
Yeah.
Some of which is discussed in our latest Green News Report.
My house is torn to shreds. I mean, my roof's there. My house is over there. My bedroom walls are down there. Absolute disaster.
Vermont slammed by second catastrophic flood in 3 weeks.
Anything that we breathe in goes to our lungs. It then gets into our bloodstream, and that's how it can have impact on other parts of our body, including the brain.
As wildfires rage in the West, new study finds wildfire smoke is more dangerous than we knew. Plus, wind and solar energy overtake fossil fuels for electricity production in Europe.
Of course, all of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The hottest day ever recorded on Earth. Suck on that, dinosaurs. We can destroy the planet ourselves. We don't need an asteroid like you.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desiree, the fires in the West continue to spread.
Yes, the U.S. West is grappling with dozens of wildfires raging after record-breaking heat waves and extremely dry conditions. Extreme fire events are striking more frequently across the western U.S. and Canada. In 2003, there were just 6 extreme fire events. In 2023, there were 67.
Wow, really?
In Colorado, at least one person has been killed as the state grapples with at least 3 major fires that have forced hundreds to evacuate. In California, where the massive park fire is tearing through areas that haven't seen fire in decades, the state has invested in clearing 1 million acres of forest a year to reduce dead vegetation and wildfire fuel. But that is likely not enough, according to wildfire ecology expert Hugh Stafford in an interview with CBS.
We probably need to come a little bit closer to 3 to 4 million acres of treatment every year. This is an existential threat for ecosystems and people across the western U.S., and it needs to be taken as such.
There's also disturbing news on the health impacts of wildfire smoke. New research finds it's not only bad for your lungs, but can negatively affect brain health, a major concern as wildfires become more frequent due to man-made climate change. Mm. A new study released by the Alzheimer's Association this week found a link between increased exposure to wildfire smoke and an increased risk of dementia.
Really?
Wildfire smoke contains contaminants from everything that it burns, and it's more toxic than regular air pollution from other sources. Scientists think tiny microscopic particles within smoke can cross the barrier between the bloodstream and the brain, causing inflammation in the central nervous system. Experts recommend wearing a good quality N95 mask to protect against wildfire smoke.
We got to start wearing those masks again?
Yes.
MAGA's not going to be happy.
We go from fire in the West to rain in Vermont. A 1-in-1,000-year rainfall event generated another round of catastrophic flash floods there this week. The fast-rising waters destroyed roads and bridges, and ripped homes apart, and triggered dozens of high-water rescues. In St. Johnsbury, Vermont, nearly 8 inches of rain fell in just 6 hours. Oh. It's Vermont's second major flood in less than a month after the remnants of Hurricane Beryl hit the same area. In southern India, search and rescue operations are underway after days of unusually intense rains set off multiple landslides that have killed at least 160 people. The Hindustan Times reports that climate scientists say the devastating landslides are, quote, the result of a combination of climate change, excessive mining, and the loss of forest cover in the region. India's disaster hits just days after torrential rains triggered multiple catastrophic landslides in Ethiopia that killed more than 250 people. But there is some brighter news.
Thank you.
In the U.S., wind energy is now generating more electricity than coal for the first time ever according to the Energy Information Administration.
Very good.
And in the European Union, wind and solar have overtaken fossil-fueled power plants in generating electricity in the first half of 2024.
Even better.
According to a new analysis from climate think tank Ember, wind and solar power generated more electricity than coal and natural gas for the first time ever in 2024, generating 30% of the European Union's electricity mix. The report found that Europe's accelerating shift away from polluting fossil fuels has cut its climate-warming carbon emissions from the EU electricity sector by one-third since 2022, despite an uptick in electricity demand.
We'll get that barn door closed no matter how many horses have left the barn. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Through the fire and rain, indeed. And well, that wasn't so bad.
No,
so,
I mean,
you had a happy ending there with the fossil fuel putting them out of business for energy, electricity production
in the
Europe.
European
That's
Union.
Good news.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, listen, this is reality, and reality is what it is. So we have to face that.
What? But we do.
But there is some other news. Six major environmental groups have endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris for president this week, including the political arms of Friends of the Earth and 350.org. The Center for Biological Diversity's Action Fund, the Clean Water Action Fund, Climate Hawks Vote, and
wow.
Food and Water Action, among others. And also they join the biggest political operations of the biggest green environmental groups like the League of Conservation Voters and the Sierra Club that have already endorsed
They're
Harris.
All on board.
Yes, they are.
All right. They're all coming together. That's
yes.
Good news for, I know, many were earlier in the administration critical of the Biden administration and their environmental policies.
Yeah, but you
Seems
know,
like they're all coming around.
They're making it clear that right. they believe Harris is the way to go if you wish to combat climate change.
Got
to
get out. My thanks to Jay Willis of Balls and Strikes, our guest today, as well as our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated. It's always an honor. Hours. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Made possible by those of you who stop by bradblog.com/donate to make a one-time donation or an automated monthly donation of anything you can afford to help us stay on your public airwaves and keep doing what we try to do every day right here on the broadcast. Thank you in advance. Drop me email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. See you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Fire and rain. The fire and rain.